Welcome to the 134th episode of Reverse Threat Radio. I'm Andy Ryan.
And I'm Toby Chad.
It's 58 years to the day since England wicketkeeper John Murray batted one-handed for exactly 100 balls over exactly 100 minutes to make an unbeaten three. Welcome to the podcast that respects that as much as any 100.
So it's, 11 o'clock at night in deepest, darkest Oxfordshire countryside for Andy. It's 10 o'clock on a Saturday morning for me, and we have got all kinds of cricketing excitement ready for you in this episode of Reverse Threat Radio. We're going to be talking about what's caught our eye over the last couple of weeks. Andy's going to be telling a remarkable story of one of cricket's great storytellers, I think it's fair to say. And we're going to be reviewing the latest edition of Wisden Cricket Monthly. So, Andy, you've been getting excited about the possibility of cricket at the African Games.
Yeah, so Crickinfo reported this week that discussions are now underway about the possible inclusion of cricket at the 2023 African Games in Ghana. So the African Games is sort of a big multi-sport event, sort of Olympic-style event. And I think this would be a wonderful chance. You know, you bring the sport to new audiences, people settling down to watch other sports get pulled into it. And it's a great boost for all those African cricketing nations who are trying to get that support. You know, this point's been made in relation to the Olympics that once you get status in one of these events, suddenly government takes an interest and they think, oh, maybe we'll put some money into this. The other thing is the potential for a tournament like this in Africa is really strong. So you obviously have South Africa and Zimbabwe as test nations. You've got Namibia, who have ODI status. But beyond that, there are 19 other members of the African Cricket Association, which I think suggests there really is an exciting chance to do something in the continent.
I think what's exciting about this too is that in order for the game to develop in areas where it hasn't, you know, totally taken root, you need both the small things, you know, you need new head coaches to come in and work in grassroots cricket and things like that. But you also need these big kind of institutional changes. You need these moments when cricket is really put on the roadmap where something big changes around the game. And this feels like one of those. So what's the, when you say it's a possible inclusion, do you have a sense of how likely it is, what needs to happen in order for it to be included?
Yeah. So it sounds like that there are conversations going on with the organising authorities and they've actually got to the point of scoping out venues and this sort of thing. So it actually sounds like they're quite far progressed. I mean, I completely agree with your point. You know, you need to give these new countries getting into the game big, exciting targets. You know, I think it's this thing that sometimes it can be hard when there's not an obvious competition. I think I remember in an episode last year, talked about the Nigeria under-19 team who took part in the under-19 World Cup. And again, you thought, well, it's so crucial to give players that opportunity because it keeps them in the game. You know, it gives them that thing to aim at, that chance to play in front of crowds. Fingers crossed. And also, you know, maybe one to put on the cricket spectator bucket list. You know, who would have thought they might be able
great?
To watch?
Yeah.
What wouldn't that?
For a kind of winter holiday to be able to, you know, spend a few weeks touring around some cricket grounds in Africa. I reckon we
wouldn't
should make that
be
happen.
Something, you know, Ghana v Rwanda or something, you know, wouldn't that be
we fun? Should apply for our press passes and do some live shows, live Reverse Rep radios from the African Games.
We're 2 years ahead of the game, so I think if we get our applications in now, we might be all right. So from the potential to build the game to a game that is very much alive, you've been out and about on the field.
I have. So last weekend, I got out onto a cricket pitch for the first time in about a year. Actually, obviously, COVID's taken a bit of a toll on all of our cricketing, I think. And one of the things, quite apart from it just being great to be outdoors playing cricket again, one of the things that really struck me was how much I've missed the kind of sort of sub narratives that you get with amateur and occasional cricket. You know, things like I was keeping wicket and we had a few new players in the side who I'd never kept to before. And you have that kind of curious thing of having to look at them and think, okay, how long is their run up? How competent do they look? How tall are they? And how confident are they? And therefore, how far back do I want to stand? Because sometimes you have those situations where you think, oh, I can probably stand up to this guy, and then suddenly you find it, you know, shooting over your head, or you stand all the way back and it's on the on the fourth bounce round your ankles.
This is exactly it, isn't it? Because my brief and not very illustrious wicket-keeping career, you think the safe option is to stand back a mile, and then you end up having these balls bouncing just in front of you in the most awkward possible way.
Yeah, which particularly on bad pitches as well, they're bound to hit some kind of a divot and kind of then shoot up into your jaw. There were a couple of other wonderful moments, one of which was our wonderful captain, who had spent weeks, you know, registering the side in the league and wrangling players and indeed ordering a very fetching new kit for us. And we promptly repaid him by dropping three very simple catches off his bowling, which just felt like a very generous way to repay him for all that he'd done. There was also my fellow opening batsman, in fact, who'd spent the off-season acquiring and then carefully knocking in and oiling his new bat. And as he arrived, he was still knocking it in, walking to the pitch, worrying about whether the edges were going to hold up or not. He went out to then face the first ball of the innings and promptly got out caught behind off the very first ball, which is just a beautiful irony. And actually, it turns out that his edges were fine.
And I think it's that moment when you've treasured this possession and you think, this is going to be the thing that changes my fortunes, you know, this beautiful new purchase that I've taken care of. And yes, there's nothing quite like that. And the first ball of an innings as well. Oh, that's the
first ball of the innings and of the season is, you know.
Oh, no, that is that sort of humiliation on humiliation. Now, you've been very modest here about your own effort, which... was in fact, I can see the entire reason behind talking about this game. So
it's so funny you should ask, Andy. But since you do ask, yes, I did score an unbeaten 55 off 30 balls. You have to retire at 50 in this form of the game, in fact. And I mean, kind of mixed feelings. Quite glad to have made that score, but also kind of now feel that the rest of the season is frankly going to be a bit of a disappointment when it comes to my average.
So 55 off 30-odd balls, you are... I mean, we're talking boundaries here. We're talking confident, you know, launching bowlers all around the park.
Listen, my first two overs were... I think I scored one off. There was a very good opening bowler for the other side, but it was one of those sides where they had one good opening bowler and then the rest of the bowlers were absolutely horrible. And so they had a leg spinner who would just, you know, serve up kind of waist-high full tosses just outside leg stump. So that's how I actually managed to get to my 50 by scoring three sixes in a row, so kind of cantering through the 40s. So I was definitely aided and abetted by some of the bowling, I'll put it that way. From the archives, and Andy's going to be taking us into the remarkable many lives of Donald Weeks.
An actor who played Othello in Moscow, a painter whose works were exhibited in Paris, a Hollywood screenwriter, a basketball player for Barbados, and a sparring partner of Muhammad Ali. Donald Rudolph Weeks was supposedly all of these, and we haven't even got to the cricket. Weeks, who we shouldn't confuse with another Don Weeks, who was the nephew of the famous Everton, was born in Brooklyn, moved to Barbados as a child, and then returned to the US to study. Now, he was a good cricketer, but nowhere near as good as his stories. But to be fair, I think few cricketers in the history have been as good as his stories.
Just before we get into the cricket side of things, you know, that remarkable list that you reeled off at the top, you know, an exhibited painter, Hollywood screenwriter, you know, boxer with Muhammad Ali. Do you have a general sense of how true those bits are of his story?
So I think there is no evidence for any of those that
right,
I've just
okay.
listed.
Yeah,
I
right.
think there is a possibility that he may well have studied screenwriting in California, so perhaps that's the closest one. I don't think there is any evidence for the others. He may well have played basketball in Barbados at some stage.
You know, in a car park somewhere, you know, it's interesting. But let's get to the cricket.
Well, let's get to the cricket. I mean, I should say it is a very good question to ask and start with, because researching this feature, you very quickly become unconvinced by the very notion of truth, basically. There are so many lies within lies that you start doubting, you know, the very basics of Donald Weeks' life. He apparently did play for the US against Canada and did so with some real success. We then get into the little lies. So he did score 100 for Barbados, but it was for the second team. A fact that he, you know, you could see why you would miss that one out. The lies quickly get bigger. So he definitely did not score 2,879 runs in a single season as the professional at Blackpool Cricket Club. In fact, there's no evidence he ever played in the UK. So Harry Pearson, who wrote Slipless in Settle, a book that we reviewed back in this podcast on episode 62, notes that Weeks never comes up in any of the research. And he says, it's a pity, really, as with his big hitting and tall tales, he'd undoubtedly have been highly popular up here.
So where do we find these accounts of Weeks doing these remarkable things? What are the sources for this?
The sources range from the reputable to the not so reputable. So there is possibly the finest account. I would strongly recommend this. You can find this online. I would suggest you take a read of the 1974 Santa Monica Corsair, which was the student paper of the Santa Monica School of Journalism where Weeks was studying. It lists his recent scores as 477 not out, 316 not out, 301, 216 twice, and 211 not out.
That lends itself to quite a good average.
It's not bad. It goes on to say, by the time he was 12, Weeks was good enough to play on professional teams in England. And it then very oddly claims that Weeks took part in an all-star game of cricket in China, which is the kind of thing that I'm just not sure that has ever existed as a thing, an all-star game of cricket in China. We would need a whole episode to cover all the non-cricket stuff in the article. There is a description at one stage of him weightlifting large numbers of scantily clad women who are standing on a table, and he talks about this in great detail. So it's an extraordinary article. The author, I think, was either in on Weeks' stories, or he was terrifyingly gullible for someone who was studying journalism at the Santa Monica School of Journalism.
Would it also be fair to say that potentially the author didn't know much about cricket, and therefore if someone presented him with these facts, that he wouldn't necessarily have been able to interrogate them in the way that he might have done something else? Like if someone came to me and told me their basketball scores or whatever it was, I'd probably just take it at face value because I have no idea, you know?
This is another reason why you should read the Santa Monica Corsair, because it includes the author's rather desperate attempt to explain the rules of cricket, which very much show that, exactly as you suggest, he had no idea what on earth the game was about, and felt that these scores were obviously perfectly reasonable. Now, in defence of the Corsair, major publications got taken in by Weeks. So Wisden, no less, published Weeks' impossibly high scores from his tours with the University of California and prior CC of Philadelphia. And I think for all my affection for Wisden, it did set me off thinking about, you know, what is the quality control? You know, when people ring up from certain parts in the world, maybe this is worthy of a From the Archives another day. You know, how does Wisden check its obscure stats? Wisden tried later on to redeem itself because they gave Weeks an obituary where it described him as a yarn spinner of international calibre, although it was rather quiet on the fact that Wisden itself had at one stage been taken in by these.
Because you would like to think, to your point about how Wisden fact-checks, that they wouldn't just, if I rang up Wisden and said, hey, you'd never believe it, I've just scored 3 triple centuries in a row, you'd like to think that they'd want to see the scorecard, or at least that they want to actually verify that the matches have happened. So I wonder whether it does, you know, speak to that kind of old school, in a way, method of journalism, which is when you know someone, you know, and you feel like it's a kind of gentleman's code, where if someone's telling you this is what they've done, then you have to kind of take them at face value, whereas you would probably think that now it would be, well, you know, let's look up the scorecard on QuickInfo and see where it takes us.
Well, that's it. I mean, I was thinking, reading all of these stories, I was thinking, could you pull this off today? And part of me was thinking, well, you know, as we've become tediously familiar with, it is very possible to spread entirely false stories on the internet. But at the same time, of course, it does give you more sources, doesn't it? There's more ways of cross-referring. So it wasn't just Wisden. The Cricketer, the June 1975 edition, was taken in as well. The best batsman never to have played Test cricket, read the article by a certain Norman Mortimer. Another startling list of improbable accomplishments is then followed by the suggestion that Sir Garfield Sobers would consider a week's innings as one of the five most outstanding batting masterpieces he has seen.
Hang on, sorry. So just to dive in on that. So that's to say that Gary Sobers did say that, or the author is saying that Gary Sobers would, if he saw this person bat, rank it among the five. I mean, that's the most tangential claim I've ever heard, really, isn't it?
No, it is bizarre. The way it is phrased, it is very clearly not a quote from Sobers. The implication is that if you were to ask Sobers, which no one did, he would say, oh, you must.
But it's
go
definitely
and see
deceptive, because if you're reading that quickly, you are inclined to think that what it says is that Gary Sobers considers him one of the five greatest. Yeah.
Well, and it's the fact that this is deceptive that has led to a theory. So I would strongly suggest Rob Steen wrote a fantastic article on weeks, but for Crick Info back in 2004. And based on my research, seems to have done more than anyone to pull together the various threads. And he puts forward the theory that Norman Mortimer was actually Weeks's pen name, which, if true, makes a lot of sense, but is also wonderfully audacious. And it does bring us to this kind of fundamental question, which is why all the lies? We don't get much insight into who he really was. So Tony Kozier, the great Tony Kozier, actually worked together with Weeks briefly on a sports desk at a paper in Bridgetown and suggested that he had the gift of the gab. So there was no doubt he could be convincing. But these lies are so vast and so indiscriminate that the moment anyone tried to scrutinise them, which they eventually did, they obviously fall apart. And you just never really get enough. There's this gap of personality there. You never really get an understanding. What are the motives here? And you're left with the sense either we're dealing with someone who had a compulsion that they just couldn't control, or perhaps a prankster having an awful lot of fun.
You would also like to, it would in its own way have been quite a lot of fun to get to a situation where kind of Surrey rang him up and went, you sound amazing, come out and open the batting for us next week. And that then, you know, on the back of that, the lie was kind of called out. It's an audacious line to continue to push in that way.
But this is the intriguing thing, is that there were elements of truth. So he clearly was a decent cricketer. And that Tony Kozier tells a story in the Rob Steen article about how he turned up at this dinner with a blazer from the US fencing Olympic team and told everyone, oh, I'm sorry, I'm late, I've been coaching the US Olympic. And Tony Kozier thought, well, I assume this is another, you know, nonsense story. But then how did he get the blazer? So
eBay.
I think it's what makes the story intriguing.
Early versions of eBay. I think this is all tips for us on how we can all construct our, you know, I often reflect on the fact that, you know, we're getting to the age where the possibility of ever playing test cricket is you know, rapidly
dwindling,
receding from view. But maybe this is the way that we can do it. Let's just call up Wisden with our latest scores. And, you know, maybe in the African Games, we can say that we scored some good runs there. Maybe let's order some stash off eBay, and then we too can be like Donald Weeks.
I think your unbeaten 55 alone is surely enough to get you into Wisden, I would have thought. To the review, and for this episode, we've been reading the January 2021 edition of the Wisden Cricket Monthly. So, Phil Walker is the editor-in-chief, and to give a little bit of a potted history, the original Wisden Cricket Monthly ran from 1979 to 2003. It then merged with The Cricketer and became the Wisden Cricketer, to which I was a long-term subscriber. In 2011, that went back to being The Cricketer, and the Wisden Cricket Monthly returned in 2017. So you had two magazines, you had one magazine, and now we have two magazines again. So you settled down to your issue of the Wisden Cricket Monthly, Toby, all 100 pages of it. What do you make of it?
Look, I mean, when you say all 100 pages of it, it is a generous magazine, actually. There's a lot in there. I actually ended up, I don't know about you, but I ended up reading it in a kind of screen version. And so it was, you know, kind of ridiculously cheap, I think a couple of pounds that you pay for it. And I actually thought that the range of content within it was really impressive. I was trying to think back, because I also subscribed to the Wisden Cricketer back in the day, or one of those manifestations that you've just talked through, can't remember exactly which one. And I was trying to think back to, you know, kind of which bits of that I enjoyed and which bits of that I didn't. And I kind of always felt in the past that there was quite a lot of kind of, you know, sort of broad audience appeal, sort of puff pieces where you hear a little bit. And there was a bit in this episode, you know, when you hear about, you know, people getting in trouble in you know, nightclubs and horrors and that funny kind of stuff. But what I was actually really impressed by was the range and the amount of kind of detailed and thoughtful pieces that there were in this edition.
I was very struck by the fact that having been a subscriber to the Wisden Cricketer, and I can't really remember, you know, sometimes you choose to not stop subscribing to something for a very definitive reason. In this case, I can't, it sort of just dropped off and I can't quite remember why. The funny thing is this felt very familiar in a lot of ways. I felt quite at home again. There was something about in the types of articles and the format. But there were a few things that were strikingly different. And I thought in particular, there was a willingness to get stuck into some quite heavy political points, which I really could not remember previous incarnations ever doing. So, you know, there was Isabel Westbury's piece on where the Marcus Rashfords of cricket are, this idea of who's speaking up as cricketers. And I was really impressed with the investigative feature by John Stern on cricket's diversity problem. So lots of warm words on this topic recently, but very little substance. And this was a really detailed article. I have to put my hand up and say I really learned a lot about the Rooney Rule, which I have regularly sort of, when I discovered what it was, I sort of assumed it was a sort of panacea, I think, frankly, to a lot of issues. And having its limitations explained was really interesting. And also just fascinating to hear how many coaches, particularly from ethnic minority backgrounds, having to work for free for long periods of time to get into work, which again was a real eye-opener.
Yeah, absolutely. One thing that I thought was well crafted was the interview with Joe Root, which you always approach those kinds of interviews with existing players, particularly existing captains, with a bit of trepidation, because you think that, well, really, in this day and age, how much are they going to speak their mind? How interesting is their mind? And how much are they just going to stick to the existing kind of PR line? But I thought there were a few interesting things that came out of it. Actually hearing from Joe Root about how the time during COVID had actually impacted him as a player, and hearing him talk about the fact that it is so rare as a top, you know, top level international player to actually have time to work on your technique as a batsman, for instance. You're just going from one game to another and you kind of know that there are things to work on. But he said he's never in his career actually had a time to, you know, to really focus on his kind of craft, I suppose. I thought there was also, he was asked about the, you know, the Test Match Championship and his thoughts on that. And it was really fascinating to see the way that he talks about that, because he was saying things like, oh yeah, there's nothing like an India-Australia series or an England-India series. And you think, yep, that's really true. But yeah, there are a whole lot of other series that aren't that. And it was just very curious to see the way that he probably does see Test cricket, you know, split into two sort of tiers as well. And also this thing, this idea that the Test Match Championship is good because it, quotes, gives you something to play for. Which again is just an interesting sort of subconscious reflection on, well, is there not something to play for in some of these series, like the Sri Lanka series that's happening at the moment? Is that, for him, does that actually mean something in and of itself, or is it, you know, does it need a Test Match Championship frame put around it? So I actually got a lot out of that interview with Root, I think.
I share your skepticism around those big name interviews generally, because I think when I opened the edition, I kind of flicked straight to the history in many ways. I was like, oh, you know, I've seen Joe Root interviewed, but it was credit, I think, as well to the interviewer that they kind of coaxed an awful lot out of him. I loved the, I mean, you talked about the range. I think you feel that every aspect of the game gets its due. So you've got the county game getting lots of attention. I enjoyed the fact that the club game as well gets coverage.
Yes.
There's a little feature about the agencies that match overseas players with clubs. And I just thought, God, that's an aspect of the game I don't think I knew it existed. And I think that's the kind of thing that you really want a specialist magazine to dig into.
Yep,
you also picked up on the fact that there's something here for players as well. There's kind of discussion of technique.
Yeah, there was a feature that with Ben Duckett about batting, 2020 batting. So he talks about this thing called range hitting, which I'd never come across before, but it's basically this idea that when there's not a game going on, you as a batsman go out into the middle of the pitch and you have someone lob kind of full tosses at you and you just smash them all over cow corner. And it gives you the confidence to then know that you can clear that boundary when you're out there in the middle batting. And there's this wonderful, and so he says that, you know, you as a kind of club cricketer can go out and do the same thing, and it's a useful thing to do, and it's something that we do all the time. And then there's this wonderful little kind of disclaimer that he adds in, which he says it can be quotes a bit antisocial, and you have to be careful of the neighbours and the clubhouse.
You can just imagine this. Underestimating a key point here, which is that I don't know if this is part of your routine, but I'm a big fan of getting a few throwdowns. And the challenge you have sometimes getting a member of your team to give you throwdowns. If I had to persuade a member of my team to toss balls up to me so I could smash them over cow corner, I think that would be a challenging
It's a bit of a debate about who goes and collects them as well, which is interesting. I think the other thing which came through is actually that the quality of the writing on the whole is really powerful, and that came through particularly in the wonderful feature on Kapil Dev's 110 at the Oval in 1990, which is not an innings. It's a series that had, I think, 15 three test series that had 15 centuries scored within it. So this one doesn't necessarily kind of stand out, and it's certainly not an innings I knew anything about. But through the quality of the writing and the observation, you just kind of, this innings comes to life in a really beautiful way. There's this beautiful line, which I'll briefly quote, which is, there was a wild swing that evaded Robin Smith's despairing lunge at the square leg, which only added to the excitement. After all, what is thrill but dismissal eternally thwarted? Which I just thought was a great reflection on the joy of watching batting sometimes.
No, and I completely agree that there are a lot of good writers here given voice, which you think this is a key role you would like to think for the Wisden Cricket Monthly. You want to give a range of writers an opportunity. And I think you would struggle. There were several historical features, actually, that felt very substantially done, sort of a considerable amount of research. I think in the spirit of balance, my one, and it's a grumble, and it's a very modest grumble, is John Hotton, who an interviewee on this podcast. Yep. We've reviewed his book. He's author of the Odd Batsman blog, reviews books, and I just felt in an issue of 100 pages, I would love to have given him a bit more room. I mean, the review's great, but I just felt, and this is an understandably very biased view coming from a podcast that's rather fond of cricket books, I was like, come on, guys, we can give more than, you know, two measly pages to cricket books.
Particularly because it was a
modest grumble.
Particularly because it's a really good writer. In that case, particularly with the new Jeff Lemon book, reviewing a really interesting book by another good writer as well. So look, in terms of the final verdict, it's an interesting one because I think it's not just about, do we recommend that people go out and buy this book? The question I'm going to ask you is, are you now going to go out and subscribe to this magazine?
I was thinking this today, and I was really thinking I would like the Wisden Cricket Monthly back in my life. The rather boring thing, I think, as you become sort of, you know, a fully grown adult, and your reading has to extend beyond the Wisden Cricket Monthly, is you sort of have your other magazines and subscriptions kind of vying for your attention as well. So I would have to, because I don't know if you find this, but the magazines subscribed to but unread.
Oh, huge.
A source of great guilt as well.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah. Yeah. No.
They taunt you. They sit there. So I
completely agree. I'm on a kind of subscription ring, as it were. That sounds very criminal and underworld. But you know, a few magazines where, as a group of friends, we subscribe to them, and then they get passed around from one person to the next, and I'm at the end of the line, which is actually really bad because there's not then the incentive to get through it because you need to pass it on to the next person. So just, you know, the number of magazines that sit in our flat and stack up, it is always a consideration with that. The other thing that you've noted is the fact that the best letter sent into the magazine wins a bottle of Michael Vaughan's brand of own brand of gin, which I think is as good a reason to send correspondence as any.
If you wonder what Michael Vaughan's been up to, other than commentating and tweeting frantically, he's been distilling Declaration Gin. So there you go. And if you'd like a bottle, write into the Wisden Cricket Monthly.
So that is the 134th episode of Reverse Swept Radio. Talking of tweeting, you can find us over on Twitter at Reverse Swept. Please leave us a review on wherever you listen to your podcast, particularly on iTunes. You can also find us over on Spotify.